You're listening to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast, where we teach you everything you need to know about adopting a plant-based diet, full or part-time. Our goal is to empower you to live a long and healthy life. You can find today's show at ordinaryvegan.net or on iTunes. If you have any questions, please send an email to questions@ordinaryvegan.net.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast number 39. My name is Nancy Monturi, and if this is your first visit, I advocate a plant-based diet for health, wellness, and longevity, for the planet, and to help protect animals. If you're new to this podcast, please listen to podcast number 1, Getting Started on a Plant-Based Diet, and podcast number 10, How to Get Optimum Nutrition on a Plant-Based Diet. I always like to begin these podcasts by thanking all of you who have been reaching out to me. I so appreciate your feedback, your questions, and your generous reviews on iTunes. I am here to serve you and hopefully provide you with every tool you need to transition to a healthy plant-based diet. On our last podcast, number 38, we had a guest called Dr. Walter Longo, who is the author of The Longevity Diet. Dr. Longo mentioned that he recommends eating fish. I wanted to say two things about that because I heard back from a few of you. I personally don't advocate eating fish, and everyone deserves their own opinion. And I also wanted to mention that Dr. Longo's 5-day fast-mimicking diet plan called ProLon is 100% plant-based. I had no idea he would recommend fish before I interviewed him since his 5-day fasting-mimicking diet is vegan and I don't believe in editing things out of interviews, especially things we don't want to hear. I have an enormous respect for Dr. Longo and his expertise in longevity. Hope that clears things up. Now today, I am excited to announce there is a new movie opening called Eating Animals. It will open in select U.S. theaters on June 15th, and eventually it will be released on streaming services. But there's nothing like watching a film like this in a theater with like-minded, compassionate people. The documentary is directed by Christopher Dylan Quinn, who also directed a beautiful film about the lost boys of Sudan called God Grew Tired of Us. Eating Animals is narrated and produced by one of our favorite vegans and actresses, Natalie Portman, and it is based on the best-selling book Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. The film received high praises from film festivals across the world, and it reveals through intimate narratives of how we have moved away from traditional farming communities to massive industrial farming complexes that produce the endless supply of so-called cheap meat, eggs, and dairy. I had the opportunity to view the film, and I think it is really eye-opening and could have a huge impact on how people view food. Today, we get to hear from the director, Christopher Dylan Quinn, and from the best-selling author, Jonathan Safran Foer. So, let's go. I think you're going to really enjoy these interviews and this movie. Hi, Christopher, and thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
In your documentary, Eating Animals, what starts out as a simple question, where does our meat, eggs, and dairy come from, quickly takes us on a journey of today's industrial animal agriculture. The movie has some beautiful cinematography and also some graphic footage. Can you tell me how you approached weaving this story together?
Sure. One of the things I kind of encountered this story when Jonathan and Natalie first came to me to work together on the making Eating Animals or adapting Eating Animals from the book into the film. I read the book, of course, but it was a whole different experience of kind of going firsthand and seeing, say, for instance, the dry lot dairies that are dotted all throughout the Central Valley of California. And that kind of, it changed the way that I looked at the landscape and kind of also the, in a lot of ways, the way I looked at America, because in a lot of ways, you know, you're seeing a lot of beauty, and at the same time, you're seeing the dark matter of these vertically integrated systems that raise the meat and dairy that we all rely on.
Yeah, I believed I was well versed about the impact eating animals has on the environment, but this documentary managed to surprise and shock even me. Can I ask you, what was your most shocking revelation making this film?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't think there's any, you know, I think there's no way to get around I look at it with, there's three lenses, right? The environment, the animal suffering, and then our own health. And of course, it's very easy to kind of consider your own personal health. But what was kind of eye-popping for me was this idea that the animals, it's not even how they're raised in these large systems, you know, some of the barns, you know, typical, I think, poultry barn has 15,000 birds in them. But that they've also been genetically hybridized or engineered or modified or whatever you want to say to a point where the advantage is for the meat companies, but the animals from the waking moment, you know, that they are, they're hatched out of an egg, they are kind of suffering mightily by their own genetics. And that to me really was a real game changer in the way that I viewed eating animals, because I originally, you know, when Jonathan and Natalie reached out to me, I was, you know, I was a meat eater. So this was something that was kind of eye-opening to me. So on average, a chicken, you know, that we've grown to rely on as a mainstay of our diet, that animal is, you know, its genetics are changed in such a way that it grows and is ready to go to market in 30 days. And if you see in the chicken and turkey farmer that I spend a lot of time with, his birds take 4 months, you know, to come to full term, at least the turkeys do. So it's kind of an amazing story. And then in the environment, we are on a course, destroying our planet with the, you know, the meat that we eat, the meat and the dairy. And this is going to get much worse as, you know, South Asia and East Asia start to adopt our so-called Western diet. It's going to accelerate us onto a path of environmental destruction.
Well, as a meat eater, or maybe you were an environmentalist, but what made you want to make Jonathan Safran Foer's book into a movie?
Well, the book itself. So, you know, and to be honest, when I was given the book to read, my initial thought before I read it was like, don't we have enough food documentaries out there? And Jonathan presented something that I had never thought about. I always thought I was kind of an educated consumer and was making right decisions about what I was putting on my plate. And his book kind of blew that all out of the water. And, you know, once you start to get this information, it's very hard to not kind of stare headlong into the system. And, I mean, I've come out the other side, you know, 4 years, 5 years later, and it's radically changed me.
How did the narrator and producer, Natalie Portman, get involved?
Well, she and Jonathan, I think, had known each other, and Jonathan, I think when he finished, I think he does, is he sends it out to friends and people to read and to get some sort of reference. And Natalie was one of those. She was I guess, a lifelong vegetarian. She, you know, she's been a vegetarian for a long time. And she read the book, and it turned her into a vegan. I think it was Natalie's idea to make it into a film. And so they got together and started to figure out ways to adapt it into a documentary.
Can we talk about the big picture of how intensive animal farming came into existence?
Yeah, and I spent a lot of time trying to figure it out, because it's only been like 40 short years, you know, I would say, where it really became as intense as it is today, which I feel is kind of hopeful in a lot of ways. It's only been 40 years that the system's been in place. But it really started after World War II, where we had all this new technology. And that technology was applied to agriculture. So in a lot of ways, you know, the fertilizers, there was a lot of conversion that took place. But it wasn't really until the 70s where I think collectively we, and I don't even put this on, you know, the corporations, but I think we really had an appetite for, you know, cheap and, you know, cost-effective food that was we could get very quickly. And that's when, you know, when the fast food, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's all really started to accelerate. That's kind of a moment where it took on this accelerated path. And I think, you know, it's as somebody says in the film, it wasn't like we were intending to make the system. It was the demand that really kind of helped create the system.
Well, can we, how did Tyson play a role in factory farming?
Well, Don Tyson was kind of, you know, it's as our good, you know, turkey farmer says, he was a brilliant businessman and very, very smart. And, you know, he grew up in abject poverty in Springdale, Arkansas. And his dad, you know, Depression era, you know, father really worked hard to create a business. And Don joined him in doing that. And what they figured out was, they call it vertically integrated, where you own every process. So you own the genetics of the chicken, you own the hatchery that hatches them, you own the delivery systems, the trucks. The one thing that they didn't really want to own, because it's the trouble spot, is the farms themselves, the expenses. That's where you could really lose. So they were able to build a system in place where they could convince farmers to grow chicken for them, but that they wouldn't be responsible for any of the bad stuff, the waste, the chicken poop. They wouldn't, you know, responsible for the barns, which were quite expensive to maintain, and the labor. So they put all of that onto the farmers, and that was a way that they could have really, you know, they could really profit in a large way. And then they just accelerated into this, you know, big, enormous plays. And a lot of that, you know, was, you know, Don Tyson convincing McDonald's to put chicken on their menu. And that was, that really kind of changed. That was a game changer for chicken on our plate. Because once that started to happen and he convinced him, it took him 10 years. He flew up on his jet every weekend, supposedly, and would talk to the executives at McDonald's about putting chicken on the menu, and that turned out, of course, to be the Chicken McNugget.
Wow. Well, while we're talking about that, that story of a contracted chicken farmer and his family who were exploited was particularly moving. And it broke my heart when he said he would never allow his children to see what he did, what went on behind the closed doors of the chicken farm. Can you tell me a little bit about that story and how you found that family?
Yes. So that's Craig Watts, who's was a contract chicken farmer in North Carolina. And I had put feelers out through a number of organizations to try and see if there was a contract farmer that'd be willing to talk to me and to participate in the film. And it took quite some time. It was one of the reasons why, you know, the process of making the film took so long. But eventually, through Leah Garces, Compassion of World Farming, we were able to connect with Craig Watts, and he had had enough of contract farming and wanted to tell his story. And he opened his doors to his barns, or the chicken houses that he had. And that's where his story starts to unfold in our film, Eating Animals. And you see firsthand what it really does to the farmer. He says in the film, he says it's not, somebody said, he said it was very close to serfdom by the time you actually look at the contracts and how it all works, is that the farmer is always the loser in the system.
In your film, we also get a shocking bird's eye view of these large pink lagoons. Can you tell us what those are?
Yeah, so this was another, you know, this was during my research, and Jonathan touches on it a little bit in the book, but there's a great article called Boss Hog that was in the Rolling Stone. I couldn't believe what I was reading about these large pink lagoons. They have a Pepto-Bismol color. They're as pink as that. And they're like patchwork over, you know, the pastoral landscape of North Carolina. And so I, like in the article in Rolling Stone, I went and met up with Rick Dove went out on a plane ride with him, Larry Baldwin and Rick Dove. And they took me up. And as soon as we got into these poor rural communities, you saw these postage stamps that are oftentimes the size of football fields, you know, and they are, you know, sewage pits for, you know, the swine that are in these factory farms. And you see these large pipes churning out this pink sewage. If you go down on the ground, when we finally landed and then we went and got very close to it, it was impossible for me to breathe. I mean, I think you have to develop, get used to it. But I because of the methane and the smell, the gag reflexes, I could barely speak, and your eyes water and you start coughing. So I can't imagine what it's like for the poor rural people that live and are surrounded by these lagoons. It's one of the issues that we touch on in the film.
And they were watering their lawn with this pink water. I just was so shocked when I saw that.
So when the pink lagoons start to fill up, they have to do something with it. And what they do is they shoot the pig sewage up into the air and spread it over what they say they're fertilizing their crops. But this is a grass that they grow just to absorb the raw sewage. It's not really, to my mind, used for anything else. But that goes, you know, that becomes aerosol and goes up into the air, and it spreads over the communities. And you have to understand, these communities have zero political clout. They're very poor, largely African American. And this pig sewage goes spraying up in the air. And it was jaw-dropping when I went down and saw that taking place.
Unbelievable. That was a very powerful moment. Also, the story of the turkey farmer, Frank Reese, I think was his name, was also compelling. And he tells us a lot about breeding and the intelligence of turkeys. And I'll never look at a turkey the same. Why was his story important to the movie? And how can a man love an animal so much, but not enough not to breed them for food?
Yeah, so it's a complex issue, right? But it's made simpler by Frank's story in a lot of ways. So Frank has the oldest continuous line of turkeys in the United States. There are 117. I think the lineage is 117. It goes 117 years. It's that far back. And they're smart animals, and they they do what they do. You know, Frank, you know, hatches them, and then they go out and they grub, and they're freewheeling, wander around his farm, and they have a turkey's life. And then, of course, there comes a moment where, you know, he has to have round them up for Thanksgiving and take them to slaughter, which is a dark day for him. He doesn't like to do it. And people often ask that question about him. But, you know, in a lot of ways, if Frank doesn't do this, these really hardy breeds of turkeys, which there's very few of them left on the planet, will completely go extinct. So the argument, I think, is made that they he has to put them on our plate. This is his argument, that in order to save them. And without these breeds, so the broad-breasted butterball turkey that everybody eats at Thanksgiving is derived from, the original genetics that are found in Frank's heritage breed. But they eventually manipulated the animals so much that they got rid of the breeder stock, these old breeds. And so Frank is really the only one that has these genetics that are really left. And the genetics are starting to fail in the poultry industry. And so the issue to really speak to is, you know, when the genetics become such a problem, you know, and the birds are suffering because of those genetics, that in a lot of ways, Frank's breed is it seems to be more justifiable to have them on the planet than the hibernized birds that we've all known to eat on our sandwiches and at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and those turkeys, just a bred so unnaturally. I mean, they don't even have sex anymore.
They're incapable. They're too obese. And that's the other thing, is that, you know, a lot of people don't realize it, but the chicken and the poultry and turkeys that they're eating have been, it's hard to use the right term for it, but engineered or modified or hibernized to such a level to grow fast. They extract the obese gene, and they make it, the animal grows very rapidly and very quickly, but it gets to a point where it can't even stand on its own 2 feet. And you can see footage where they're actually having to take conveyor belts to get the turkeys onto the trucks to slaughter.
Ay. There's also a story of the scientist veterinarian James Keene, who worked at the U.S. Meat Animal Resale Center in Nebraska, and he became a whistleblower. Can you tell us a little bit about his story?
Yes. So Jim Keene, he worked at the United States, what's called U.S. MARC, and it's the Meat Agriculture Research Center, and it's smack in the middle of America, Nebraska, and it is where the U.S. military stored a lot of their ammunition in World War II, and they converted that farm land or that facility into a research center for meat. And Jim Keene worked there as a veterinarian for years, and it was a kind of a slow unraveling of a man's, idea of, I guess, being a veterinarian, right? And he finally has had enough, and so he starts to document internally all the things that are taking place there that I think most people would consider horrifying. Research on animals, manipulating their reproductive systems. There were things that were taking place that I think would have shocked the average American. And Jim finally contacted Michael Moss of the New York Times, a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalist. And he wrote a compelling story about the U.S. MARC, and Jim was included in it. After I read that, I went to Nebraska and knocked on his door, met his family, and Jim was really in a difficult place because he had blown the whistle. I don't think he initially wanted to get found out, but he was exposed while bringing Michael Moss onto the farm, And there, you know, being in Hastings, Nebraska, if you're, you know, the industry is king there. And so they were dealing with being ostracized by the community and also the university where he worked, and U.S. Mark, which he was banned from going to. So I kind of caught up in their lives right when that moment was happening and watched the damages that blowing the whistle can really cause on a person's life and also on their family's life.
If you could look into a crystal ball and could you tell me what is the future of meat in the way of raising food after making this film?
Yeah. So, I mean, first I'd like to say, you know, I think I really tried hard to make the film feeling that anybody could come in and have a place in, to, you know, at the table. So if you're a meat eater or a vegan, I think there's, I like to think that there's a, you know, it would be entertaining for anyone. But here's the thing, the film is actually, you know, even that we're discussing all these, the dark matter of it, I feel it to be really optimistic. And here's the reason why, you know, the crystal ball question you just asked is that we know that there's all these problems. And I think generally the public knows there's probably something wrong with the meat and dairy that we eat. You can, I know you have been dealing this with for many years, but when you talk to somebody, they really, they either say, I don't want to know, or they, and or they say, I know it's, there's a real problem there. But there's solutions that are taking place. And that's why I included a big section on the plant-based alternatives. So the stuff that's taking place now, like Beyond Meat or Impossible Burger or Memphis Meats, all these these new startup companies that are creating plant-based meat that is arguably as delicious as a beef burger. And so that technology is in full swing, and they're really getting underwritten by a lot of very wealthy people who believe the future is in plant-based alternatives. So I don't think there's going to be a world when humans aren't eating meat, at least not in my lifetime. But if people have an understanding that they can't just consume the cheap meat that we've been doing for the last few decades and have to really kind of take it off the center of the plate and not eat it as much. And then that mixed with the idea of these plant-based alternatives, we can radically change the way our environment is being degraded and our own type 2 diabetes and obesity we'll have less of a problem with that. And so there's a number of things moving forward, and I feel like we're really at this, there's a tectonic shift that's taking place where people are starting to understand that, especially younger generations.
I agree. So before we end, how can people actually see this documentary?
So it opens June 15th in New York and then June 22nd in Los Angeles, and then it spreads to other theaters, and we have a number of places. But you can go to the website that IFC and Sundance Selects has put together, and there'll be a schedule, full schedule. I'm really excited that it's going to theaters, and then eventually it will go out into video on demand and to other places on the internet like Netflix or Hulu. I'm actually not sure where it's going to end up there.
Well, I'll keep our community updated on all the dates in all the cities. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Nancy.
Congratulations on your documentary. I am really looking forward to seeing how many lives you're going to change. And I know it's going to happen because I saw the movie.
Thanks very much. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Now, I am excited to welcome our second guest, Jonathan Safran Foer. Jonathan is the author of Eating Animals. Jonathan's debut novel, Everything is Illuminated, was hailed by the Times as a work of genius and was also made into a film starring Elijah Wood in 2005. His second novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, is narrated by a 9-year-old boy who lost his father in the 9/11 attacks. Eating Animals is Jonathan's third book and was written in close collaboration with Farm Forward, which is a nonprofit organization that implements innovative strategies to promote conscientious food choices and help reduce farmed animal suffering. A Los Angeles Times article said that eating animals contains the kind of wisdom that deserves a place at the table with our greatest philosophers. In a Huffington Post article, Natalie Portman claimed that the book was so powerful that she went from a 20-year vegetarian to a vegan activist. According to a piece by The New Yorker, the power of eating animals lies in its ability to discuss why humans can be so loving to their companion animals while simultaneously being completely indifferent to the ones they eat. Let's welcome Jonathan Safran Foer. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello.
So thank you so much for being here today. And you wrote your book, Eating Animals, back in 2009, I believe. Why did you want to bring it to the screen?
I think just about every writer wants to bring just about every book to the screen because, I mean, for the most obvious reason is it creates a lot more readers, right? So if you write a book because there's something that you care about, something you believe in, whether it is, as in the case of eating animals, kind of advocacy, you know, or a political or ethical point, or in the case of a novel, it's much harder to describe what it is, if it's a set of characters or a story or a voice, but there's something that you believe in and want to share. And, you know, in the year 2018, or for that matter, any year in the last 100, the audience for film really dwarfs the audience for books. So if there's a way to, you know, give a book a filmic language or version, and it both gets the message out and it also draws people to the book itself. In this case, I think there's something else, though, which is the discussion of factory farming it's a good story to tell, but it's also a very powerful story to see with one's eyes. And I was aware of that when I was writing the book, that how much I wished that the book could have a visual language, because there are things that you can see that, you know, really are worth 1,000 words. I decided not to give it a visual language for a couple of reasons, one of which was I was worried in the book about, you know, throughout the book, I was worried about losing the audience because it's a very sensitive subject. You know, it makes people feel oftentimes defensive or aggressive or just grossed out. I think people are used to the idea that any conversation about meat is going to be violent or scary or accusatory. And I went to lengths to avoid that. So I didn't give, you know, in a book, you can't really contextualize an image in the way that you can in a film. So if I showed an image from a slaughterhouse, somebody's going to open the book, you know, flip through the pages, deciding if they want to read it, see that and say, no way, not for me. In a film, you know, Christopher is able to pause on somebody's face or pause on a landscape to show how violence or environmental destruction is embedded inside of a larger story. And I think it's extremely powerful. So I looked forward to having those tools as well, you know, in addition to just the sentences and paragraphs that I had when I was writing the book.
I agree. One of the most powerful images was that bird's eye view visual of those pink lagoons and seeing water, seeing a lawn being watered with this pink water. It was just stunning.
Yeah, you know, I could have described that at any length, and it wouldn't have had the power of that one flyover image.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's definitely a case where a film can do something that a book can't.
How did Natalie Portman, as your narrator and producer, get involved in taking your book to screen?
I've known her for, 20 years or so, maybe even more. And I knew that this was an issue that she was interested in. And so when I was writing the book, I shared a draft of it with her. I can't remember if she'd asked to see it or if I asked her to look at it. I don't remember. But in any case, she looked at a draft. This is before it was published. And she said, hey, you know, when this book comes out, I'd really love to try to make it into a film. And then I thought that sounded great. So that was how it originated. It wasn't a kind of business origin. It wasn't a industry origin. It was just two friends like caring about the same subject.
Well, your book, which by the way was way ahead of its time, is part memoir and part investigative reporting. And just like your book, we see every dimension of factory farming in this documentary. Can you tell me what was the most powerful moment in the film for you?
In the film?
Yes.
I think in a way this is going to avoid your question, but it's my best way of answering it. The most powerful thing is actually the accumulation. It's not any one particular thing. So, you know, it's horrible to see those pink lagoons and to start to grasp the environmental destruction. It's really horrible to look inside that hen house, the factory farm egg laying facility, and to see all of those dead and suffering and diseased animals. It's really horrible to hear small and family farmers talking about what this industry takeover has meant to them, to their livelihoods, to their senses of themselves, their senses of their occupations. But all of it together is, I don't know if I would say it's greater than the sum of its parts, but it has a quality of being really irrefutable. There's really no way of looking at factory farming that makes it appealing, which is one of the reasons the industry doesn't like to talk about it. You know, when my book came out, I would do radio interviews and TV interviews all the time, all over the place. And often the producer would want to have somebody from the industry come and debate me. And they could never find anybody because the industry knows that the more we talk about it and the more faceted the conversation becomes, the less likely people are going to be to buy those products. So their best strategy is just simply to avoid or try to silence the conversation. And what was so powerful about the movie is how broad a conversation it was. And it really felt like a conversation to me rather than an argument. And I think that if people are open to it, and I really appreciate how hard it is to be open to it, because it seems, I don't think that it is, but it seems scary, you know, or it seems scary both in the sense of the material is scary and scary in the sense of what it might ask of us. You know, like you have to completely change your life or accept that you're a hypocrite. When in fact, there's another way of looking at it. And I think, you know, Christopher is actually a great model for that. Himself, he approached this film absolutely not as a animal rights advocate or a vegetarian or vegan advocate, but as somebody who's curious. And I think it makes him a very trustworthy guide. You know, one of the things that the film does very well is it doesn't feel manipulative. It doesn't feel like it's concealing some kind of secret argument while pretending to be open to the truth. I think he really was open to the truth. And I know from, you know, the responses that I've already heard from people who've seen the film that it feels very conversational and very open and really not only not scary, but quite inviting.
Yes, I thought the same thing. I felt like I was on the journey with him, like he was discovering these things along with me, you know? And that's a great documentary filmmaking, to say the least.
Yeah.
When you wrote your book, were you trying to convince people to stop eating meat, or did you have other reasons, and have your reasons changed since you wrote your book?
I think it was a process, you know, so I learned. I didn't know the conclusions when I began, and I certainly didn't know the information when I began. As I wrote the book, I become an argument against factory farm meat. I don't know if it was exactly an argument that I was making to others or an argument that I was making to myself. I think, you know, we shouldn't underestimate how it's unfair and it's unrealistic and it's not constructive to underestimate how hard it is for most people to change the way they eat. You know, like on paper, it might all seem very simple and like a no-brainer, but the reality is it's difficult for most people, and it requires not only being persuaded once, but kind of like being persuaded on a regular basis until the cultural norms change. You know, it's always this way with things that are new or that ask us to look at the world differently or to live in the world differently. So when I was writing the book, in a way, I kept making the case to myself. And I think, you know, by implication, I was making it to whoever was reading the book. And it's something that I continue to think about and continue to talk to myself about. You know, I haven't written, obviously, any other books on this subject since then. But I think of it as a really alive question. One of the interesting things about this subject is that it presents itself as very scary and off-putting. But in fact, it's just a great conversation to have. Like if you do it the right way, which is not with a wagging finger and, you know, a page of statistics, but instead a kind of humility and an openness, like, what do you believe in? Here's what I believe in. Where do you come from? Here's where I come from. What's hard for you about changing? Here's what's hard for me about changing. What are your hopes? Like, how do you envision your participation in the world? Here's how I think about, you know, my citizenship. What's your family like? Here's what my family's like. One of the things that makes this conversation about meat so potentially fraught but also so inspiring is how many different aspects of life intersect there, you know, whether it's the environment and animals or whether it is religion and sort of national cultural identity, whether it's like the intersection of what makes us feel comfortable and what makes us feel guilty and what makes us feel proud. It's a center of a really vast web. And I used to have really bad conversations on the subject that ended with people getting upset. And I think I had a lot of learning to do. And one of the things that I learned in the process of writing the book was not only what factory farming really looks like and what small farming really looks like, but also what the conversation might look like and how to have it in a way that made people want to participate instead of wanting to escape it.
In April of this year, the President of the United States and federal government passed a $1.3 trillion spending bill that has a provision to exempt factory farms from reporting the toxic emissions they generate. And our government also eliminated the animal welfare rules, which set higher standards for the treatment of animals. It feels very scary to me, and it feels like we're going backwards. Do you have an opinion on how the average person can fight back to require factory farms to follow basic environmental laws?
Well, I would say two things. First of all, happy as I might be to blame or critique Trump, this is old stuff. And this was true during Obama, and it was true during the Bushes, and it was true during the Clintons, Bill Clinton, that is. There's never been any kind of regulation on the environmental effects of factory farming. There's always been like huge subsidizing of both that destruction and the cruelty to animals, not to mention like human illness. you know, what these things that what we know that they're this food is doing to our bodies. So this is old stuff, and there may be ways in which it's been worsened, but it doesn't feel like we were just pushed off some kind of cliff. To me, it feels like we're just following the same arc. I don't have any hope at all for solving this problem with legislation. That may just be my own pessimism about how politics works, but it's coupled with a kind of extreme optimism about the power of the individual. Nobody forces us to eat this stuff, and it is only as successful as we make it. If we withdraw our support, then we will solve the problem. It's really that simple, and it makes it so unique among the really big problems in the world right now, many of which require electing a new government or require spending billions or even trillions of dollars or finding a new set of ethics. And this really doesn't. If people just acted on the beliefs that they already have, and I don't mean, you know, undergraduates at Berkeley. I mean people all over the country, evangelical Christians, and atheists, Republicans and Democrats, old people and young people across races, across socioeconomic divides. There just aren't people who want to destroy the environment, and there aren't people who want to abuse animals. And if we were able to act on those shared beliefs, which doesn't require everybody going vegan tomorrow, but just pausing and reflecting on what they want to support with their money and what they want to put in their bodies, if we acted collectively, then we could solve the problem. And I think there's actually a real, it can be a distraction to blame others. You know, in a way, Trump is too easy a target, and when we should really be looking at ourselves.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that, but because bringing that to the forefront, you know, seeing those posts on Facebook, look what he's doing. You know, it has been going on for a long time, but now people are like, oh, you know, that shouldn't happen. So for the first time, people are saying that shouldn't happen. So maybe it's a double-edged sword, you know?
Yeah, and yeah, I completely agree.
You might have answered this in a little bit, but in addition to your book and your movie, how do we create a new narrative about eating animals?
Well, I think the new narrative is very much already alive in high schools and colleges. There are more vegetarians than Catholics in American colleges right now. So I think that will become more and more obvious as time passes and as those who are now students become journalists and politicians and celebrities and all of that. And I think the rest of us have to simply just keep the conversation both alive and also humble. You know, for years and years, for decades, like the voice of the anti-meat, for lack of a better way of describing it, movement was PETA. And the slogan was meat is murder. And there's a lot to admire about that. And there's a lot to admire about the ways that they did what they did, and their accomplishments probably make them the most successful like social justice organization in the last 50 years. But it's not enough. And while they have been able to convert, let's say, one or two out of every 10 people, and that's absolutely phenomenal and deserves like huge respect and credit, we really need the other eight or nine. And meat is not murder is not going to work. It doesn't work for most people. But there is a kind of conversation that does work, and it isn't monolithic. You know, different people are reached in different ways. Some people care a lot about the environment and don't care at all about animals. Some people care a lot about animals and don't care a lot about the environment. Some people care about antibiotic use on factory farms. Some people care about the plight of family farms. There are a lot of different ways of approaching it, and we shouldn't try to force any one way on any one person, but, you know, meet people where they are and show them that you're not asking them to live by your ethics. You're asking them to recognize their own ethics and to find ways to, you know, bring their actions closer to their beliefs.
Do you see yourself writing another book about the environment or about eating plants?
I might. Yeah. Oh. It's certainly an idea I've been thinking about, the kind of how environmentalism has stalled in a certain way, and how even those of us who believe that we care really don't care that much in terms of the lives that we lead. You know, we make this like very sharp distinction between climate change deniers and the rest of us. But as seen from above, or as seen by future generations, I don't know that the difference is going to seem all that stark. You know, it's between somebody who says, I don't think humans are playing any role in climate change, and people like me who believe the science but don't really do that much in our lives. Certainly don't act as if we believe it, even if we intellectually believe it. And eating is the most powerful thing that we do as individuals, as citizens, with regards to the environment. So I've been thinking about ways to sort of have that conversation a little bit differently.
Well, I can't wait. So my last question for you is for all the writers out there, and I wanted to know, where do you get your inspiration for your work?
So, you know, I've been a writer now for maybe 18, 19 years, something like that. And I don't know that I've ever felt inspired. And I don't think people should seek inspiration or wait for inspiration. Most of writing, in my experience, is just work. And you sit down and you lower the bucket and it comes up with nothing, and you lower it again and it comes up with nothing, and you lower it again and it comes up with nothing, and you lower it enough times and you come up with something. But it requires sticking with it, and it's a kind of prolonged act of will, which is often unpleasant. You know, inspiration sounds great. Writing doesn't often feel great. It's a lot of work. But what you get on the other side of that work is pretty magical. And I think that the magic, in a way, is even greater exactly because there isn't inspiration.
Love that. Thank you so much for being here, Jonathan.
And thank you.
Congratulations on turning a compelling book into what I believe is going to be a game-changing movie. And I can't wait to see what changes it brings about.
Thank you. It's so nice to talk to you.
Nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Thank you, Christopher and Jonathan, for joining the Ordinary Vegan community and podcast today. And thanks to all of you for being here. Before I go, I just want to say one more time, we welcome everyone here. You don't have to be the perfect vegan. Every plant-based meal you eat improves your health, helps the environment, and protects animals. My number one goal is to help you become as healthy as possible, and with great health comes great happiness, and you're worth it. If you are suffering from chronic pain or any anxiety disorder, please head over to my website to learn more about a natural food supplement called CBD oil made from hemp. Many people in the wellness world are turning to CBD oil for its powerful anti-inflammatory and anti-anxiety effects. And what is driving the business of CBD oil is not the pharmaceutical industry, and it's not the medical industry. It is the people. People who were backed up against a wall and they were willing to try anything for their anxiety, their migraines, their arthritis, their depression, and their chronic pain. And they tried CBD oil and it worked. You can learn more about vegan CBD oil from hemp on my website, ordinaryvegan.net. Links for everything we spoke about today will be in this week's show notes, including a link to Jonathan Safran Foer's book, Eating Animals, and to the documentary movie, Eating Animals, in all the cities where you can view it. You should also join our super supportive health and wellness community on Facebook, where we are over 315,000 strong. Just go to facebook.com/ordinaryvegan. Thanks, everyone. Till next time.
Thanks for joining our plant-based community today. Together, we can accomplish great things. Please subscribe so you don't miss any of Ordinary Vegan's recipes and plant-based tips. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at questions@ordinaryvegan.net. Until next time.